it to the White House, and I got clearance to be a participant in the speech.
So as you were escorted out by the security, you were taking a great risk, Genesette. You're undocumented. You're a trans activist from Mexico. What did they say to you? And you were you concerned that you yourself would be in jeopardy?
That is correct. I knew that was a big risk to take. But to me, I've always been a risk taker. And the message and giving the voice to my community that don't have that voice, what's more important, you know, facing any consequences. As I was being escorted out, the Secret Service and the security were just very silent. They weren't questioning me or giving me any specific orders. I just continue to path out of the White House. Once I was out there, they kind of held me for 20 minutes or so. They wanted to double-check my identity and basically...
Well, Genesette, we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, Genesette Gutierrez, undocumented trans activist from Mexico, with founding member of the group Familia TQLM. This is Democracy Now! Tomorrow we'll be in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Special happy birthday to Malik Nickens and Karen Ranucci.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
It's that time again. Time for another three-day community festival at Good in the Hood 2015, which is sure to bring even more than before. Starting June 26th through June 28th at Lil's Albina Park, there will be a celebration of community with live music, kids space, lots of local foods, and a chance for health screening too. KBOO is also in the Good in the Hood parade, and we want our members and volunteers to participate. For more information, contact Ani Haynes at volunteer@kboo.org. Again, Good in the Hood, Friday, June 26th through Sunday, June 28th. And KBOO will be broadcasting live on Saturday, June 27th. See you in the hood.
I know it's a lot of bad out there, but guess what?
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, June 27th from noon to 3 p.m. for a special preview of the Waterfront Blues Fest, taking place July 2nd through 5th. We'll have KBOO DJs hosting Peter Damon, live music, and more, celebrating the 28th annual Waterfront Blues Festival. Again, that's an afternoon of blues previewing the 28th Waterfront Blues Festival, Saturday, June 27th from noon to 3. Stay tuned from 3 to 10 p.m. for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Supreme Court voted this morning to uphold a key provision of the Affordable Care Act.
The Federal Elections Commission has reported large donations to national legislators voting in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
For KBOO News in Depth, we'll look at three Washington State teenagers who are part of a legal battle demanding the state respond to the effects of climate change.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 2015. I'm Alan Montecelio.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Retail sales of marijuana to adults could begin in some parts of Oregon on October 1st. The legislature's Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91 today amended and approved Senate Bill 460. SB 460 allows a so-called soft start for retail marijuana sales by allowing currently licensed medical marijuana dispensaries to sell to anyone over 21. But there are some limitations. I spoke with industry consultant and lobbyist Sam Chapman earlier today to find out more.
Right Right. So the committee has been considering what they call early sales, or what Senator Farioli calls on-time sales, for quite some time now. The issue came up very early on in the session. Given that July 1st, Measure 91 stipulated that July 1st, citizens 21 or over in Oregon can possess, grow, and consume cannabis, but cannot purchase it. And so that raised the question of, okay, well, where are they going to get it? The default answer being the black market. And so that question was tabled for a couple of months while a lot of medical legislation was getting worked out. And as of about a month and a half ago, the question surfaced again, what are we going to do? And so essentially the committee, and I applaud them for taking this on, has worked out a bill to allow early recreational sales to start in existing licensed medical marijuana facilities on October 1st. And I think it's going to be a great thing for the medical industry and the recreational industry in general.
Delaying until October 1st means that cities and counties will have the ability to enact a prohibition on that early start, basically forbidding their local businesses from doing that. Do you foresee that happening in much of the state? And what do you think will happen here in Portland?
So I think Portland in general is going to be safe. Portland has always kind of been hands-off thus far. I know that next week they are starting to convene meetings about enacting local regulations here in Portland. It'll be interesting to see what comes out there. In terms of the rest of the state, the measure stipulated that if you could only put a ban in place if your county voted against Measure 91, 55% or more. And so that essentially is every county east of the Cascades. I suspect a majority of those counties will initially put a prohibition on recreational dispensaries. And so it'll be interesting to see if there are people in those counties that go elsewhere, or if they allow deliveries inside those counties. It does not change the fact that people in those counties can still grow their own, possess their own, and smoke their own. So I think with that fact given, it won't take too long for those counties and cities to realize that they're missing out on tax revenue and giving back to their community. I mean, these sales means a lot for small cities that really are hurting right now, that in some cases don't have enough money for police enforcement or firefighting or those type of things. You know, I think that recreational cannabis can really help a lot of these communities, and I think that'll be a driving factor for those communities to reconsider their position after a little while, after they see the money that can be generated through recreational cannabis sales.
And now they're also talking about changing the tax structure from a tonnage tax at the producer level, which would probably be multiplied at each step along the way, to essentially a sales tax of about 17%. That would be collected when the OLCC starts issuing permits, as opposed to when these dispensaries start the soft sales. Do I have that right? What is essentially the timeline we're looking at before people are going into retail shops and getting that paying that sales tax on top of their purchase?
I believe January 1, 2016 is when that's going to start to be put in place. The Department of Revenue is actually going to be in control of the taxes, which was different from what Measure 91 stipulated, which was that the OLCC would handle taxes. And when the legislature asked the OLCC how quickly they could put together a tax structure, they said mid-2016. That was not soon enough for the legislature. They wanted to make sure that they could start collecting taxes as soon as possible, but they knew that they weren't going to be able to implement a tax structure on day one, July 1. So that's where the Department of Revenue stepped up and said, we could put this program together in 4 to 6 weeks. The legislature has afforded them a little more time to put that together, but I suspect January 1, 2016, we will see the tax structure in place in cities that allow recreational cannabis to be sold.
Fantastic. Sam, any last thoughts?
You know, I think this legislative session has definitely been a roller coaster ride. There have been a lot of highs. There have been a lot of lows. I think overall, it's been a great session. The legislature and the 91 committee specifically has really come out and taken the time to educate themselves on this issue. Again, there have been rocky points, but I think the fact that we're now moving forward, licenses are starting to come together, rules advisory committees are meeting, we're really starting to get the first glimpse of what retail cannabis sales in Oregon is going to look like. And it's nothing short of exciting.
I've been talking with Sam Chapman from New Economy Consulting. He's a drug policy reformer here in Oregon. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News. Non-medical purchases would be limited under the measure. Adults would be allowed to get a quarter ounce of flowers or one plant per day from dispensaries. A marijuana sales tax measure, HB 2041A, passed the Oregon House earlier this afternoon and now goes to the Senate.
Federal officials awarded over $6 million to property owners in Snohomish County, Washington, for homes and land damaged by last year's mudslide. The county had requested nearly $9.5 million for property buyouts, but they say the $6 million is a good start. The mudslide killed 43 people and destroyed 40 homes. The county will use the funding to pay the assessed value of the properties before the mudslide. A ban on building new properties on the land is still in effect and will likely remain so for the foreseeable future.
Oregon Senate Democrats scrapped a deal that would have funded public transit upgrades and road repairs at the expense of the state's Clean Fuels program. The deal was reached between 8 Democratic and Republican lawmakers. Republicans insisted they would block any transportation deal unless the Clean Fuels program was repealed. But when Governor Kate Brown and some Democrats agreed to repeal the fuels program in exchange for a transportation deal, Senate and House Democrats refused to support the compromise. Governor Brown had said that lawmakers must pass a transportation bill before the legislative session is over, but now she says that there simply isn't a path forward.
A new Harvard study found that nearly half of all home renters in Portland are cost-burdened, meaning they spend at least a third of their income on housing. People all over the city are being forced out of their current homes due to continuing rises in rent prices. Rents in Portland have increased twice as fast as home prices, according to Zillow, a real estate company. The city of Portland controls rent prices for only 13,000 units, even though nearly half of the city's renters are in need of assistance. The city council will meet next month to consider a bill that will require new rental properties to offer a certain percentage of units at an affordable price.
The Federal Elections Commission has revealed corporate donations to members of Congress who support the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. In the Senate, for example, over $1 million were contributed specifically in support of the TPP, the bill for fast-track authority that would allow the president to push the TPP through Congress without debate or amendment. The 65 senators voting in favor received an average of almost $18,000 each. Amounts were even higher for senators running for re-election next year, including Oregon's Ron Wyden, who changed his position and became one of the foremost champions of the fast-track bill over just 24 hours. Wyden, along with two other Democrats who formerly opposed the legislation, received over $100,000. Other 2016 Senate candidates were given up to $120,000 each to support Fast Track. The U.S. Business Coalition for TPP includes Pfizer, Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, and Monsanto. Its efforts proved highly effective at converting many Democratic holdouts and securing the votes of Republicans. The fast-track law was passed by the Senate twice over after being returned by the House, where opposition was stronger. The latest Senate vote was held yesterday and confirmed victory for supporters in the legislature, the Obama administration, and corporate backers.
Today, independent Vermont Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, as well as Democratic Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky, introduced a bill in the U.S. Congress that would close tax loopholes for wealthy families. The bill comes 2 months after a repeal of the estate tax passed the House in April. President Obama has pledged to veto any repeal of the estate tax, which taxes inheritance money, and has been famously referred to as the death tax by conservative opponents. Today, political watchdog group Public Citizen released a report detailing the sources of funding for lobbying for a repeal of the estate tax. KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Susan Harley, deputy director of the Congress Watch Division of Public Citizen, for more on the battle over the tax.
It sounds to me like this the report that you issued highlights a gulf between what is claimed to be the reality of the estate tax and what the actual reality is in terms of who it affects.
Absolutely. So right now, there are many in Congress who would say that the reason that the estate tax should be repealed, which we do not believe, but they argue that it punishes small businesses and family farms, but yet there has been no evidence of any family farm lost due to payments required by the estate tax. It would not affect 99% of the American public. And when you look at the value of farm estates, you'll see that the average of those are only $2.8 million, and that's much lower than the current threshold for the exclusion, which is $5.43 million per individual or $10.86 million per married couple. So the vast majority of farms would not be taxed under the estate tax as it currently stands. Yet billionaires are the ones who are actually lobbying to have the estate tax repealed. Our evidence shows that between 2012 and the first quarter of 2015, nine families spent more than $10 million on this, including $3.5 million exclusively to repeal the estate tax. And then just given some of the limitations of our lobbying disclosure, some $6.9 million lobbying spent on issues that included the estate tax.
Obama has pretty much pledged to veto any repeal of the estate tax that comes to his desk. It does sound like members of Congress are pretty amenable for one reason or another to repealing it.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, there was legislation in the House of Representatives sponsored by Kevin Brady from Texas that has already passed the House of Representatives with more than 100 co-sponsors. And if you look at the testimony from some of the hearings, they over and over use this myth of the family farms and the small businesses as being those who carry the burden of paying the estate tax.
So today, actually, a bill was introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Jan Schakowsky. And can you explain what exactly this bill is aiming to do?
Sure. It closes loopholes that are right now in the estate tax. I've mentioned before this exclusion amount that already exists of $5.4 million. So that would reduce the exemption amount to $3.5 million, $7 million if you're a married couple. And then it would increase the rate of the estate tax. Right now it's 40% as the maximum. It would increase it to 45% for estates between $3.5 million and $10 million, 50% for estates between $10 million and $50 million, 55% if the value of the estate exceeds $50 million, and then there's an additional surcharge on the couple of hundred billionaires that we have. That's a 10% surcharge.
What would the impact of a repeal of the estate tax be if it were to actually go forward?
Right. Well, we already get quite a bit of money in our coffers for the federal government from the cost of the estate tax. So off the top, we'd be losing that money. And, you know, that's really important as we're looking to fund our government agencies. I think that also we just see more income inequality. The figure that we would be losing is $246 billion from 2016 to 2025. And so that's a substantial amount of revenue that could be used for education. It could be used for roads. It could be used for healthcare. There's so many important things out there that we right now say we don't have enough money to do effectively. So I think that the American public will be calling for changes. We just have to have the will of the people prevail.
Susan Harley, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Susan Harley of Public Citizen.
This morning, the Supreme Court voted 6-3 to uphold key aspects of the Affordable Care Act. Among other things, the act allows states to establish insurance exchanges to allow people to shop for a suitable insurance plan. The Supreme Court case focused on one phrase of the act, which seemed to suggest that people must use exchanges established by the state in order to qualify for subsidized health care. The problem is that about 36 states around the country have exchanges which are run by the federal government, not by states. That means a win by the plaintiffs would have made the subsidies provided by those federally run exchanges illegal. The Supreme Court ruled that even though the phrase was ambiguous, the, quote, context and structure of the act led to one interpretation over the other. The president had this to say about the decision.
After nearly a century of talk, decades of trying, a year of bipartisan debate, we finally declared that in America, health care is not a privilege for a few, but a right for all. Over those 5 years, as we've worked to implement the Affordable Care Act, there have been successes and setbacks. The setbacks I remember clearly. But as the dust has settled, there can be no doubt that this law is working. It has changed and in some cases saved American lives. It set this country on a smarter, stronger course. And today, after more than 50 votes in Congress to repeal or weaken this law, after a presidential election based in part on preserving or repealing this law, after multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
Last night, an undocumented trans activist was escorted out of the White House after interrupting President Obama. President Obama was speaking at a celebration for LGBTQ Pride Month when activist Genesette Gutierrez jumped in and asked him to, quote, release all LGBTQ detention centers and to stop the torture and abuse of trans women in detention centers. Gutierrez spoke this morning and explained her actions, saying that, quote, there is no pride in how LGBTQ immigrants are treated in this country, and there can be no celebration with an administration that has the ability to keep us detained and in danger or release us to freedom, end quote. President Obama criticized her for interrupting him at the White House. Here is audio footage of the incident.
I've told you that the civil rights of LGBT Americans
President Obama.
Yeah, hold on a second. Okay, you know what? No. Hey. Yeah, listen. You're in my house. Come on. It's not. You know what? It's not respectful when you get invited to somebody. You're not gonna get a good response from me by interrupting me like this. I'm sorry. No. Shame on you. You shouldn't be doing this.
2 days ago, Congress wrote a letter to the Department of Homeland Security asking them to release LGBTQ migrants in detention centers.
The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a case that tried to narrow the scope of the Fair Housing Act, one of the nation's most important civil rights laws. The act was passed in 1968 and explicitly allows lawsuits over race discrimination in housing decisions. The court bucked a recent trend of scaling back other civil rights laws, including their decision to strike down key sections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. They voted 5-4 to maintain the housing law, citing its, quote, continuing role in moving the nation toward a more integrated society. The lawsuit concerned housing developments in Texas, where groups claimed that government subsidies had negative effects on minority communities. The ruling stated that discrimination in housing does not have to be intentional to be harmful or, ultimately, illegal.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth, followed by Rose City Native Radio on at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is hot and sunny, with a high of 99 and a low of 68. Today in history, in 1940, France officially surrendered to Germany in World War II. In 1950, the Korean War began after North Korea invaded South Korea. And in 1978, the rainbow flag representing gay pride was flown for the first time in San Francisco. The quote of the day is from Barbara Ehrenreich. Quote, "The working poor, as they are approvingly termed, are in fact the major philanthropists of our society. To be a member of the working poor is to be an anonymous donor, a nameless benefactor to everyone else."
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Neither rain, sleet, nor snow, nor even the likelihood that he'd be killed, could stop this letter carrier from making his appointed rounds. Doug Hughes is one gutsy mailman. In April, this rural letter carrier from Florida embarrassed Washington's haughty security hierarchy and threw members of Congress into chaotic panic by boldly flying his tiny, homemade gyrocopter right through the heart of our nation's most restricted airspace, landing it on the front lawn of the U.S. Capitol. Far from a terrorist or a kook, Hughes was just a mailman on a mission. Like most of us, he's disgusted that big money can openly buy lawmakers and laws. But he did more than write a letter to his Congress critter. He wrote letters to all 535 of them, loaded the missives in his mailbag, and literally went the extra mile to make a very special delivery in his gyrocopter. This was no flight of fancy. Doug planned his mail delivery for months, and he was fully aware that he might crash, be killed by a scramble of military jets, or be gunned down by guards when he landed. Nor was it a sneak attack. He repeatedly posted his intentions in blogs, and the Secret Service had investigated and interviewed him about his plans more than a year earlier. His landing jolted the Capitol into lockdown. Guards rushed out to arrest Doug. A bomb squad arrived, and lawmakers were scared silly. They ran around screeching that they were threatened by terrorists. Of course, the real threat to America is not some guy flying a gyrocopter, but the utter corruption of Congress by plutocratic elites whom this mailman targeted, with nothing more nor less dangerous than a bagful of truth-telling letters. This is Jim Hightower saying, actually, Hughes was not alone on this heroic mission. The great majority of us Americans are totally on board with his bold effort to finally shape up Congress.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, introduced a resolution this week to remove state flags containing any portion of the Confederate battle flag from the House side of the U.S. Capitol grounds. But Republican House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy has delayed the measure by referring it to committee. Representative Thompson opposed the referral and spoke on the House floor to urge passage of his bill.
Mr. Speaker, to someone who's lived his entire life in the state of Mississippi and had to endure a symbol that represented bigotry, hatred, and everything this country is not, I'm convinced that an effort to remove this flag from the halls of the House of Representatives is the right thing to do. We all know the history of the South. We know the secessionist motivations behind the Civil War, and my ancestors were those individuals who were held in bondage against their will. We are a nation of laws. We should not identify with symbols of hatred and bigotry. That flag, those symbols,
should be put in a museum. They should not be flown under any circumstance where there is freedom and dignity in this great institution of ours. I know it's a hard choice for members to do, but I saw what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, last Wednesday. The whole world saw it, and they did not like it. And so this is one step toward getting us healed as a nation. So I take it very personal. I've had churches burned in my district. I've had men and women killed for trying to do the right thing. And yet when I see people trying to defend that way of life under which that flag represents, this is not who we are as an institution. And because of that, I offered the privilege resolution. I understand where we are with it, but I have issues with it. I appreciate the gentleman yielding the 2 minutes, and I urge my colleagues to oppose the referral of this resolution to committee.
But Kevin McCarthy's referral motion was approved on a roll call vote of 240 to 184. So the measure now goes to the House Administration Committee for consideration. The vote was split along party lines, with only one Republican, Kurt Clausen of Florida, joining the Democrats in opposing the delay.
Shepard Fairey is probably most known for creating the iconic Barack Obama Hope poster used in the 2008 presidential election. However, Detroit police have issued a warrant for his arrest following a visit to the iconic city. Fairey was in town to paint a building that he had been commissioned for. However, police believe that while he was visiting the city, he may have tagged up to 14 buildings. Of the 14 buildings that were marked with Fairey's trademark art, only 9 property owners wanted charges filed. Police say that if Fairey enters Detroit, that he will be arrested for vandalism, which they say has cost over $9,000 in damages. Fairey stated in an interview earlier this month that he intended to create his art without permission while in the city, explaining that it was a balance between credibility and professionalism.
New York City's Energy Commission is considering whether or not to renew its biggest nuclear power plant. Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant has been running in New York since 1962 and has been running its current reactors since the early 70s. Advocates for the plant point out that it accounts for $340 million annually in taxes and supplies nearly half of the power needed to run New York City. But critics of the plant cite multiple safety record issues and violations. Because the company that owns the plants filed for a new permit before the old one expired, they are allowed to continue running their reactors until a decision is reached.
A judge in Kansas has blocked a law that would have banned abortions during the second trimester. The Center for Reproductive Rights filed the lawsuit. Attorney Genevieve Scott for the center says that this is important for the women of Kansas, since this ban would have required women to go for a more complex procedure with greater risk. Only 10% of abortions take place in the second trimester, so the ban would not have affected the majority of procedures. But this decision is especially significant for abortion laws all over the country. If the block remains in place, the Kansas Supreme Court would protect more abortion rights than the U.S. Supreme Court does.
When people register a new website, they often have the option to keep their personal information hidden from public view. But new rules proposed by the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, reveals the identities of people who register their websites. The new rules are intended to help law enforcement and entertainment companies pursue people who are using anonymous websites to commit illegal acts over the Internet, including privacy. But the new rules have also upset some domain owners, as a website that uses ads to help offset the cost of running the site may be considered commercial. Privacy advocates are concerned that the new rules will impact the free nature of the Internet, making people less likely to speak up when they can be tracked. ICANN is also accepting public comment on the changes until July 7th.
Tomorrow is the UN's World Drug Day. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement to commemorate the event in which he called for a more balanced approach to drug control. In full compliance with human rights standards and norms, the United Nations advocates a careful rebalancing of the international policy on controlled drugs. We must consider alternatives to criminalization and incarceration of people who use drugs and focus criminal justice efforts on those involved in supply. We should increase the focus on public health, prevention, treatment, and care, as well as on economic, social, and cultural strategies. The Support Don't Punish Coalition is working to make June 26th a global day of action for drug policy reform. I spoke with Steve Rolls of the Transform Drug Policy Foundation to find out more.
Well, Support Don't Punish, it takes place on World Anti-Drugs Day, or the, I can't remember exactly what the title of the day is, but it's a UN event. And usually it's the day that the World Drug Report is released. And it's historically been a day in which the UNODC and the UN drug agencies that are very kind of conservative drug war status quo agencies unleash a whole bunch of propaganda about how great the war on drugs is. And so the idea of the Support Don't Punish campaign was really to challenge some of that, challenge that sort of status quo narrative and say, actually, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you're not talking about. The war on drugs isn't helping people, particularly people who use drugs. It's actually harming them. Punishment isn't an appropriate response to a public health problem. We need to be providing harm reduction and treatment and services for people who use drugs, not punishing them, criminalizing them, and imprisoning them. So the idea of Support Don't Punish It is to have a kind of civil society response to reclaim that day for common sense, reason, and evidence. And that's been the idea behind it, and it's really taken off. So the first year, I think there was 20 cities. I think last year there was 110. And this year there's going to be, the target is 140. So it's a genuinely global campaign, and there's actions all over the world on every continent. And last year in particular, it really dominated the media on that day. So it really stole the thunder from the UNODC and reshaped the narrative. So it's a really successful global civil society led campaign to reshape the drug policy debate.
Once again, I've been speaking with Steve Rolls from the Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Protests started in Armenia on Friday after an electricity rate hike was announced. The Armenian government estimates that electricity rates will rise $3 to $5 for most people living in the country. This particular rate hike comes at a time when the nation's currency is in a free fall. The government had been subsidizing the Armenian currency to keep it at 300 drams to the dollar, but once money ran out, the value of the dram fell 30%. With the threat of a continued drop in currency values, slight increases to utility bills become especially painful for residents. Earlier this week, Russia accused the U.S. of assisting the decline and stated that the area was undergoing the same changes that the Ukraine recently went through. But protesters deny that they are being influenced by foreign governments and say they are simply upset over price increases. Largely peaceful protests in the capital of Yerevan have been met in some cases with police beatings and water cannons. And Human Rights Watch has accused government forces of targeting journalists and destroying their equipment. Electricity to Armenia is provided by the Russian company InterRAO, which has stated that it has no interest in politics and that its rate hike was simply a business decision.
The recent murder of a Canadian Indigenous woman is bringing to light Canada's dark history with Indigenous women. Tina Fontaine was found dead on August 17, 2014, wrapped in plastic in the Red River near Winnipeg. Tina had gone to Winnipeg to reunite with her estranged mother, only to be picked up for drunk driving and put in the foster care system. She's part of decades of violence committed against Indigenous or First Nations women in Canada. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police found that in the past three decades, at least 1,017 Indigenous women were murdered, and an additional 108 women went missing under suspicious circumstances. First Nations women are four times more likely to go missing or be murdered than other Canadian women. Nahani Fontaine, an advisor on Aboriginal women's issues in Canada, says Indigenous women are targeted because of prejudices established during the colonization of Canada. Problems with discrimination, the foster system, and Canada's history of westernizing First Nations people prevent any real progress from being made. Tina's aunt, Thelma Favelle, is hopeful that Tina's death can help mitigate the extreme violence and move towards safer, longer lives for Indigenous women.
People arriving and leaving from the airport in Paris have become trapped in a battle between Uber and local taxi drivers. The Paris courts found Uber's European app, called UberPop, to be illegal, but the tech company is still operating in Paris and is working on appealing the decision. And a group of angry taxi drivers has begun protesting the company, even attacking Uber vehicles that arrive at the airport. Protesters have smashed windows, overturned cars, and set fires. French riot police have been dispatched to attempt to stop the unrest in the area. The protests gained national attention when singer Courtney Love tweeted that her car had been held hostage for nearly 2 hours by men with metal bats. While passengers in Uber cars do not appear to be the targets, many drivers have experienced damages to their vehicles and intimidation from Paris taxi drivers.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 24th, 2015. Israeli settlers attack and destroy farmlands, and troops fire tear gas into residents' homes during invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli radical settlers destroyed on Monday morning farmlands owned by Palestinian farmers from the village of Taibe near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. According to Palestinian sources, the settlers set a vast area of land on fire that was planted with wheat near the northern entrance of the village. The villagers told local media that the settlers came from the nearby illegal settlement of Romanim, originally built on lands taken from the local farmers. In other news, a number of Palestinian civilians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation on Wednesday at dawn when Israeli troops invaded Al-Arub refugee camp near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Residents said that the army vehicles stormed the camp, then troops searched and ransacked a number of homes. Later, troops fired tear gas into residents' homes, causing many residents to suffer effects of tear gas inhalation. Elsewhere, Egyptian military forces have started digging a massive tunnel along the borders with the Gaza Strip, according to Days of Palestine. The tunnel is intended to help the Egyptians to monitor the smuggling tunnels between Egypt and Gaza. Although these tunnels are used to take essential goods into the besieged territory and have been described as Gaza's lifeline, the government in Cairo claims that they are a threat to its security. The tunnel is expected to be 2 kilometers from the actual border, and it will be 20 meters deep and 10 meters wide. According to news sources, local Egyptian residents complained that preliminary work has already destroyed their farmlands, which are their main source of income. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 24th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron, Nathan Behensky, Catherine Maticek, Doug McVeigh, Alan Montecilio, Robin Ryan, Shade Samuelson, and Ryan Stroyer. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Alan Montecilio.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Ani and Lynn discuss resistance and letting go with Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Evolutionary Biology from University of Arizona, about the likelihood of near-term human extinction due in part to abrupt climate change. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, we hear a talk by Remy Kanazi, a Palestinian-American performance poet and human rights activist who spoke at Portland State University on divestment on school campuses. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts a panel discussion with presenters from the Mathematics, Education, and Society Conference, a biennial international conference being held this week at Portland State University, exploring social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics education. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.